Lost Lycra, Toy Story Cafe, good evening and welcome to Hague. And we're blessed to welcome two experts in their field. Back again today, we have Carl Lee, who is a lecturer in the Department for Lifelong Learning at the University of Sheffield. His research interests include urban planning development, sustainable development, localism and community engagement, and urban ecology. He published 5 books, including Everything is Connected to Everything Else. Danny Gawley is a social geographer and the Hanford Mathilda Professor of Geography at the University of Oxford. His work concerns issues of health, employment, education, wealth and poverty. He has also written a number of books, including People and Places, the 21st Century Atlas of the UK, A Better Politics, How Governments Can Make Us Happier, and jointly they have written this new book called Geography, Ideas and Profile, and they will be signing copies of the books afterwards. Please would you give a warm hey welcome to Danny Gawley and Carl Lee.
Good evening, everybody. We're obviously here to talk about geography, and it's a subject that we've taught and thought about for decades, really, between us, and we're going to try to take you on a bit of a geographical journey tonight, or this afternoon, using some maps that have been drawn by our friend and colleague Benjamin B. Hennig. The D is very important, you'll understand as we go through this, the store that Ben puts on precision in things as well. But I want to introduce to you, first of all, my friend and fellow geographer, Daniel Dorlin, author of so much work and so many books and papers and general round stuff and journalism, that my moniker for him really is the hardest working man in geography. But that's probably not entirely true, because we do actually go on holiday together with our families and we build huge sand excavations on beaches, stare at sunsets and drink far too much red wine. And it was on one of those holidays on the Ile de Ré in France that we sat down with a bottle or two perhaps of red wine and we came up with the idea of this particular book.
We actually finished a book in the Jura. We have a thing about France, and we're congratulating ourselves now that we're here and not driving around searching for a petrol station. And you should all congratulate yourselves too, because we were just talking about the carbon footprint of hay, and although the driving to hay is not good, it's far better than driving to France. My job is to introduce Carl. Carl is the most inquisitive man in geography, and despite, I think, 3 decades of teaching the subject, particularly at A level, he still finds it interesting. But we're not going to tell you too much about the words in the book. We're really going to show you the 7 maps that Ben Hennig drew for us for the book, which form the core of the book.
Yeah, we're going to start our journey in Dalian, in northeast China. It's an industrial port, a huge industrial port, many millions of people live there. It's where an awful lot of China's manufacturing bounty is shipped out of, exported to places like us. And on this map, you can actually see it's just there at the top right-hand corner. But the question to ask yourself to begin with is, why does this map look so different compared to other maps of the world that you've seen in the past?
Right. We've done this talk a few times before, and Ben's got quite annoyed that we don't describe things exactly. So we've got some cards to make sure we do it exactly. But I'm going to have a go. Every single grid square in there, which is a square of longitude and latitude, has its area drawn proportion to the population who live in that area. That is why India is large and China is large, and why the Americas are relatively small. What you're also seeing is the communication lines between places. You're seeing the roads. You're seeing shipping lanes, you're seeing telecommunication cables, I think including submarine cables, but not aircraft routes, because they would have made the map slightly too... We wouldn't have seen Europe and North America because of the number of flights over the top. So this is a map of where we are as a species and how we are connected to each other, showing you the route of a single ship.
And that single ship is the MSC Oscar, that at the time that it left Dalian was the world's largest container ship. Its maiden voyage was in 2015, and it's a leviathan of a craft. It can deliver to us in Europe 13.8 million solar panels in one trip, or if we choose not solar panels, we could deliver 38,000 cars in this one single journey. Now, if we went back 1,000 years and thought about trade between Europe and China 1,000 years ago, any trade that was going to happen would have been happening via a camel, and we sat down and we worked out how long it would take a camel to get from Damascus to Sham, which was on the end of the Silk Road, city of 1 million people even 1,000 years ago, and that would have taken about half a year with all of the problems of terrain and all of the hazards that the people would have encountered. Even 3 centuries ago, if you'd have been making the same journey, you'd have had to have been relying on wind energy and ocean currents to trade around and through the, because Suez Canal wouldn't have been built by then, around the Cape of Good Hope.
We started off with this particular image because geography has changed. If you're the age of Carl and I, and you did geography at school, you were taught the geography of empire, or the tail end of it, the geography of how we control other people, how we control other resources. The subject now, the core themes of the subject now are globalisation, sustainability and equality. That ship actually steams slightly slower than it could do to minimise the amount of fuel it uses. It is bringing us, sadly, not solar panels, because the Germans buy them and we haven't yet worked out we really ought to buy them from China. It's bringing your iPads, your TV sets, plastic toys and cheap clothes from factories. Although all those things we are consuming slightly less of. In return, we are sending back wealth and occasionally rubbish in the ships to be disposed of. And as we do that, as we send our wealth back, the world is slowly becoming more equal, but the amount of stuff that's being moved around is a great deal more.
Okay, we're going to move on to a second map here. One of the ways in which we divide ourselves in the world is that we believe that we are, or some people believe that we are parts of different races. We are not. We are all part of one race, the human race, the dominant species upon this particular planet. And we've achieved that dominance in an incredibly short space of time. Now, this map, we're playing around with information that we knew. And so this is a map that we've drawn to the best of our ability of knowledge that we know at present time. And that knowledge could change. Because one of the things we learn in geography is things that we asserted to be so. Maybe 20, 30, 40 years ago, or 40 years ago, we were talking about imminent ice ages, and we've learned that that's clearly not the case. So we know that knowledge changes, but this is given to the best of our knowledge. And we can see that out of Africa there, and we've hedged our bets a little bit here, we've suggested that between 120,000 and 75,000 years ago, there were various movements out of Africa. And of course, from those movements, we can all relate ourselves back to a single woman, mitochondrial Eve. No one's haggling over whether she did or didn't exist. She existed. We're just haggling over where she existed, almost certainly the plains of East Africa, and when she existed. So you could actually think about us as a species. We are all related to each other. This is our common tradition, our common heritage.
This is one of the maps we had to change the most as we were doing the book, because very annoyingly, scientists kept on publishing papers in Science and Nature with new discoveries, and hence there are some quite big error bands on when we left Africa to try and keep everybody happy. Maps also often have holes in them. So the hole in that map, the thing which isn't being shown, are any dates in China. Partly because we'd like to sell the book in China, it's being translated in Chinese, and there's an enormous amount of dispute about when people arrived or not. How do you deal with that? You just don't put a number on the map. Geography is a very old subject. Map making is older than writing. The oldest maps in the world were drawn on the walls of caves, and they actually show people dancing in a field. So it could be slightly like the Hay Festival, but there isn't that much dancing here.
I don't think anyone's drunk that much yet, Danny.
Nope.
Yeah.
Later on.
Yeah, later.
we are incredibly inquisitive people. We move around and migrate at an incredible rate. It's interesting that people often talk about trying to stop migration. You can't stop migration. When we went down the Americas, we were moving at a rate of about a mile a year at which people flooded down from the top down to the bottom. Partly people were pushed, partly they were inquisitive. We also trade enormously. We move goods around enormously. The point Ben wanted me to make about this map is that the underlying base map is the current population. If we'd been more ambitious, we'd have tried to make area proportional to all the human beings who've ever lived. But that actually is a somewhat disputed number, so it's not that easy to do. But you're looking the most sure dates on that map at the end dates. It's when did people finally arrive in what we now call New Zealand. Madagascar is the most amazing course. And if you just want one thing to think about when you're looking at that, think about all the poor sods who drowned trying to get across in other ways. I mean, these are the tiny numbers of successful people who made these particular trips. Geography has always been of most interest in places which have been the centre of trade. So it's ancient Greece, ancient Rome, the early Chinese state, Indian subcontinent states, where geography mattered. And then, of course, the British Empire. That's why geography mattered to us. But going back, observing global trade in 1621, the Portuguese trader Gomes Solis observed that of the world, silver wanders throughout all the world in its peregrinations before flocking to China, where it remains as if it's in its natural state. In 1621, China was the world's most advanced and economically successful state. Its rise today is a reassertion of its historical dominant role.
Back in 1988, I was backpacking around the world with my wife, who's somewhere in the room here, hasn't heckled me yet, which I'm a little surprised already, and I found myself standing on the flat roof of a building, Red Lodge, in a place called Kagbeni in Lomas Dang in Nepal, and it was just the last place you go before going over the Phrong La Pass, an 18,000 foot pass on the Annapurna Circuit. And it's really an amazing place. And at that time, there was no electricity. And I was standing there looking above, and it was really the first time that I'd ever seen the Milky Way in all its wonderment. And that dazzling Milky Way, the silence, the lack of natural light, it was the first time I really felt that I was on a planet spinning round an orbit in the sun. I felt incredibly small, incredibly insignificant, incredibly alone. Now, today, we went back to the Red House. It has electricity. It has a phone signal. It even has its own page on TripAdvisor, where people moan about the quality of the phone signal, amazingly. We live, effectively, in a far less lonely world. We live in a globalised world. And hundreds of millions of people around the world are continuing to join us in this globalised world. And this map tells us something about that globalised world.
It does. This is the map of where to go if you want to get away from it all. You can actually zoom in and in and in on these maps. The lines of longitude and latitude all remain parallel to each other but pushed apart. They tend to still cross at 90 degrees. If you zoomed in far enough, you could navigate on one of these maps. Now, this is the last pedantic point I have to make to keep my colleague Ben, who drew this, happy. What you're seeing here is each tiny area of the globe made larger in proportion to how long it would take you to walk there from the nearest town of 50,000 people, taking into account how your walking speed would be affected by altitude, elevation, and latitude. Ben is a perfectionist.
But Ben is also German as well, and he really likes to get things just so.
Yes. So there we are.
Okay. Right. But nearly everywhere in the world that we are today, everywhere is connected to everywhere else in our Anthropocene world. And what has enabled this incredible degree of connectivity that we now experience is one key factor, and that key factor is energy, or more specifically fossil fuel energy, first of all coal and then oil and now gas. And that's really propelled global capitalism since the 18th century. Now back in 1900, and I just need to check this down here, back in 1900 we used 50 exajoules of energy globally. And that 50 exajoules is 10 to the power of 18, if you're wondering how many noughts there are that with that particular measure. And that supported 1.65 billion people back then. Now, 50 years on, fast forward 50 years, and we've got a global population of 2.5 billion. But that global population of 2.5 billion is sustained by 100 exajoules of energy which are being consumed globally. So the rate of growth of energy use is far greater than the rate of growth of population. Another 50 years on, we find ourselves at the millennium, we've got just over 6 billion people, but by then we're using 500 exajoules of energy. And not only are we using more energy, we're using that energy far, far more efficiently today than we did back in 1900. And so therefore, our connectivity comes out of our use of energy.
And our connectivity is changing how we think about the world. It's making us feel that space is becoming compressed, that over there is now over here, which worries some people. Whether it's cuisine, culture or conflict. And we're moving around more. We've moved plants around the planet in ways that has altered nature itself. We move goods around, we move money around. And this process is actually accelerating at the moment, and it can cause people to become scared at the rate of movement. We are currently at the greatest rate of increase of global population. In just 12 or 13 years, you get an extra billion people. It's not surprising that you think everything is changing fast. We know that nation states don't stand alone anymore, which is why you need to vote to remain in the EU. They sit within a complex economic architecture, some of which we can see, but much of which is hidden from view. It's like an iceberg. The iceberg beneath the tip of the visible economy is a shadow world economy, and that includes the trickle up of money to the super rich, the money that's hidden in Panamanian accounts, which we found out about recently. Everything is connected with everything else, and so we're forced to go from pollution through to energy, through to money, through to migration, if we're going to look at geography.
Okay. Now, you won't be surprised that, if you know Danny's work, that we're going to talk a little bit about living in an unequal world. But you might be a little surprised that we're not necessarily going to paint a picture which is as stark as you might imagine that we would actually paint. This map here does show a fundamentally unequal world. There's two pieces of information being displayed on this particular map. The blue scale here is annual precipitation, rainfall that is experienced at different parts of the world. And of course, it's been set across a population density map for the whole world. And so what you can do when looking at a map like this is that you can clearly identify those parts of the world where there is going to be significant pressure on fresh water in coming decades. There already is in many of these parts of the world. You can also identify quite clearly those parts of the world where such pressures are unlikely to happen, and new challenges. Excess water will be an issue that people will have to think about and come up with solutions for. So struggling to supply water to meet need, we can see, for example, I haven't got my little red dot thing here, but you should be able to spot Egypt up there. Significant problem there in the Gaza Strip, perhaps the most acute problem in the world. The UN only a few years ago suggested that the Gaza Strip would be uninhabitable by the year 2020 because of its water supply problems. You can also see the large area of the Indus Valley dominated by Pakistan, and it always brings to mind the novel, and I often use novels in the teaching of geography, but the novel of Mushim Hamid, How to Get Filthy Rich in Asia. And of course, if anybody's read that novel, how do you get filthy rich in Asia? You sell water, indeed you do.
There are many other ways that we are unequal, apart from our position over the amount of water we get or don't get. But there are many ways in which things are getting better. Although the population of the planet increased by 50% between 1985 and 2015, the average amount of nutrition per person increased by 10% on top of that. And if some of us didn't eat as much, we would be in a much better position as well. If you look at healthcare, the improvement in healthcare, it is staggering. If you look at life expectancy, for the planet as a whole, it's been going up by a third of a year since at least the 1970s. In the past 200 years, life expectancy has doubled. Infant mortality rates have fallen most in the areas which are poorest. It is not simply a question of everything getting worse. Many things are getting better.
There are, of course, quite a few buts in this geographical optimism. We may be seeing greater equality enacted in many countries in the world, and we may even be seeing greater equality between certain countries in the world, certain nations in the world, and particularly of interest to us is India and China, because these two nations between them contribute 2.5 billion, maybe a little bit more than 2.5 billion of the world's population, and they are becoming increasingly more equal to us, although not necessarily more equal within those countries themselves. Yet, and this is the big but, of course, we are bearing witness to a new hyper inequality. As the global elite, and for me the global elite isn't the 1%, it's the 0.1%, continues to create and capture a greater and greater proportion of global wealth. This wouldn't necessarily be disastrous for us if this global wealth that they were capturing was recycled back around the system and put back into the real world economy. It was invested into offshore wind, it was invested into new agricultural technologies and into broadband for all. But so much of this wealth now is hidden away, is stored, is unproductive. And really one of the things that it seems to be producing more than anything else is fear, particularly strangely amongst those people that actually hold this wealth, who now set themselves apart from us, the 99.9% in their gated communities on their super yachts, and of course tropical islands with sophisticated banking systems.
But at the same time as Oxfam is telling you that the number of people who can fit in the bus have more wealth than the poorest half of the world, Branko Milanovic has just published a book showing that for most people in the world there's been an equalisation of incomes, and in fact it's been people in the richest 20% of the world who have seen the smallest increase in their income, apart from that tiny group that we all know about. So there is a coming together, there's a growing global middle class. The rise hasn't been that high at the bottom, but there's been a rise that's been bigger than for people like you and I. However, this is all precarious. We're living in a world with a highly unsustainable financial system. Andy Haldane, I think he's got various posts. One is Deputy Governor of the Bank of England. I think we've got an ex-Governor of the Bank of England in Hay at the moment. Andy goes around the world telling us about how likely the world financial system is to crash. You know, you really should listen to that. We live in a world where we rely on everything working. It all has to work to feed us well, to water us, to clothe us. And it is not a robust system for future progress.
Okay, we'd like to show you this map. This map really shows us where most of our food comes from, and food's going to be an incredibly important issue in the 21st century. It already is, of course, an incredibly important issue. And so the map is being resized to reflect the production of food crops produced in each small grid square. So you can see the Great Plains, Central Europe, West Africa, all enlarged, because these are big areas of food production. So I'm stealing your lines here, I think.
That's fine. We're going to speed up, because we're going to give you lots of time to ask questions. And you'll be glad that there are only 7 maps in the book. Because each of these kind of issues can raise so many other issues. The question that people always ask is, okay, that's our breadbasket now, but how are we going to feed another 2, 3, 4, or 5 billion people? I happen to think it'll be 2. But I also happen to think that if it were 5, we wouldn't have a great problem feeding them, just as long as we learn to eat a little bit less meat, to waste quite a lot less food, and for those of us who eat too much, not to eat too much. Water is a much bigger problem than food.
These are one of the things that me and Danny haggle about over a bottle of wine. He thinks too, I tend to think a little bit higher. But we do agree on the reality that an intelligent humanity is almost certain to be able to feed a population of 10 billion, maybe even 11, 12 billion as well. And of course, producing food is one of our most energy intensive activities. It's not simply the harnessing of sunlight to power photosynthesis, but the fertilizers that are required, the mechanization that is required, the transport of food crops from where they're grown to where they're actually consumed. All of these things consume huge amounts of additional energy. And all of this has to be done in a world where accelerating climate change will significantly change ecological parameters in which food is actually produced. And we do have some historical precedents to give us some insight into what that actually may mean. Back in 1783, the Laki fissure in Iceland erupted, and it plunged most of Western Europe into a decade of climate chaos. Crops failed. Religion had an incredible resurgence, and a revolution occurred in a country where a revolution looks like it's going off a bit at the moment as well. And a more recent volcanic eruption in Iceland. Do you want to mention the name of the volcano?
No, okay,
we'll leave that. I always thought that was the ultimate question on an A-level geography paper. Write the name of the volcano that erupted in Iceland.
But do you remember when it erupted and all the flights stopped? The world didn't end, did it? And you could actually look up into the sky and it was empty. You know, things were a bit tricky if you were trapped there, but the financial system kept on going without bankers actually having to have face-to-face meetings. They could phone each other up.
Yeah, and we will have to produce more, but more importantly than that, we will actually have to think about how we can distribute what we produce more fairly, and we will really need to consume less.
Yeah, we're going to have to moderate our affluenza. But we already are. As I told you, for the richest 20% of people in the world, they haven't seen much of an income increase in the last 20 years. Our trade union was on strike this week because real pay has gone down. But the world hasn't ended for us. What really knocks us is that the pay of some other people is keeps on going up. And that is our problem, because what do we need to buy? We need to buy houses, and they only cost more because other people are competing for them. And we need to buy wine, and it's the same problem.
There are limits to growth, though, of course. I want to read you... going to get to this particular slide here. I want to read to you two very important statements which were made this time last year in June, actually, just a month hence. The first was from Angela Merkel, and she was at the G7 conference in Bavaria, in Germany, and she said unequivocally, "We aim to decarbonise the global economy in the course of this century." And a few weeks after that, and this after that statement, that was written on the G7 communique, and it was signed off by our leader, David Cameron, as well. So we'll assume that he's committed to that as well. A few weeks after that, Pope Francis, in his papal manifesto, stated, "Today, in view of the common good, there is urgent need for politics and economics to enter into a frank dialogue in the service of life, especially human life."
Okay, I've got one quote for you. I think one thing about the book that's unusual, I think we have more references to Chinese academics than to American academics. This is a quote we think is entirely reasonable. It's from Xi Jinping, the premier of China. It was made on his ascension to supreme leader, and the quote is this: Our people love life and expect better education, more stable jobs, better income, more reliable social security, medical care of a higher standard, more comfortable living conditions in China, and a more beautiful environment. And I think we need to begin to understand that is what they're going to get, that is what they need, and we are currently consuming probably the most in material terms that we will ever consume.
So it brings us to the future, and at the end of our book we start to play around with a range of scenarios thought out by the International Panel on Climate Change that consider the implications for a range of development pathways that are potentially in front of us and their consequences for global climate change. Now, it's fair and it's a good criticism to make that these are made on a myriad of assumptions, and some of these assumptions may not be correct. We could haggle over them for days, if not weeks. But they contain within them a range of climate outcomes, and of course, being scientists, they hedge their bets, they make a lot of caveats along the way. But these climate outcomes that reflect the types of behaviours that we could particularly engage upon. Now, simply put, if we do not follow the advice of Angela Merkel of moving towards a decarbonised global economy, if we do not follow the advice of Xi Jinping in China, or even the Pope, we're inviting upon ourselves an increasingly insecure and uncertain future. It is strongly suggested by the IPCC that a global system of cooperative supranationality based around the concept of sustainability is the most beneficial to humanity in terms of its impact upon climate change. So you can imagine that as something like a greener, much greener, more sustainable European Union as a good starting point for that. In fact, if we go on beyond our generation, because I don't think it's going to happen in my lifetime, I feel that the way forward is a very, very sustainably focused United States of Europe. But I think we're still, as the current debate suggests, we're still quite a long way away from that. But it's this global cooperation based around the idea of sustainability that the IPCC suggests very, very strongly is going to be our best, most successful pathway through the potential chaos of climate change which will envelop us throughout the 21st century.
The main alternative to this that's being suggested is what's called competitive localism. You cut your borders off and you simply compete on trade to try and outdo your neighbours. This is what Nigel Farage wants, this is what Donald Trump wants. The map behind you is the Earth and Night map, but it's showing you the places that are producing the most and wasting the most light. And it's showing you where the centres of competitive localism will be in future. If we go for a future where everybody's in it for themselves and we forget about the externalities, what happens if we simply compete to all try to become the richest?
Yeah, I think this is an amazing map, actually. It's a composite map, of course, with all the light reflected back at us of where humanity is at its most dynamic, its most active, its most populous. And there's a few bits and pieces that really jump out of you here. The little loop here down at the bottom of China, the Pearl River Delta, which is now a continuous conurbation of 110 million people. Cities that are joined together, that are interlinked without any breaking up of countryside to set them apart from each other. And so this is the world that we have shaped on our planet. This is our modernity. But given that we started back in the past with the spread of humans across the planet, we're actually going to finish off with a bit of a nod to the past. And Ben Hennig produced for us a modern Mapper Mundi, which we shall just click up. Yeah.
There we go. So this is our final map. This is my last chance I can muck it up over the accurate description of this one. So again, it's the world shaped by population, with each part of each country correctly sized. So in fact, the country boundaries don't matter. The map would look exactly the same without those national borders on it. The only difference between all the maps you've seen so far is that we have shrunk the oceans and the seas away. And suddenly we are on the edge of the world. We're no longer in the centre. If you're my age, you grew up with a map on your classroom wall. I'm not old enough to actually have the pink bits coloured pink, but the UK was bang set in the centre. If you're a bit younger than me, you'll have had the Arnold Peters map, where countries were made the area they actually were, and Africa got a bit bigger. These are the kind of maps we think that our children will begin to see in future. Very, very different ways of looking at humanity that they are part of. Now, the last chance to get this wrong. The very centre of the world on this map, it's in India. Or to be exact, it is just outside the Rajasthani city in Udaipur.
Udaipur,
I knew I'd get it wrong. And we were very good, or I think you were, because it's actually very cheap land. And we did think of buying the centre of the planet and putting up a post there, but we haven't done that, so please don't any of you do it too and set up a small tourist centre.
Actually, one of the places just down the road from the population
gravity
point.
He's been there, of course, you know.
Been a geographer, patrolled there many years ago, but just up the road from it is the Monsoon Palace of Udaipur, which, if you've ever watched Octopussy, the James Bond film, part of Octopussy is actually filmed at the Monsoon Palace as well. And of course you can go and see a map very, very similar to this, 20 miles away at Hereford Cathedral, an ancient map of Mundi, which reflected the known knowledge of the world at the particular time that it was drawn back up. I couldn't be able to put an actual year on it. I'm thinking 16th century.
Yeah.
700 years ago.
Sorry? 700 years ago.
Thank you
very, very much.
Okay.
Yeah. And what we really are leading up to here is this idea, and what all of these maps have attempted to persuade you of, is that geography as a subject really is going to be the subject of smart, humane, rational folk who will increasingly turn to geography as a tool in order for them to understand the tripartite challenges of the 21st century: globalization, sustainability, and equality. These three things are the stuff of geography today, in our view.
Geography is becoming the subject of the future. It's changing from having been the subject of control and domination to being a subject which is about hope, which is about how future generations will survive, how they will get on with each other better, how we'll deal with resources together, rather than dealing with other people's resources and taking it off them, which is what I was taught how to do when I did A-level at school. And this changing thinking will require completely new images and completely new maps, as well as new ways of thinking about things. Academic subjects don't normally change this quickly, but this is where we think geography is going, and we hope you've got some questions for us. Thank you very much.
Hopefully there's a few people with microphones in the room. One of the things that me and Danny are very conscious of is that when we write things down, is looking back on them 20, 30 years down the line, and us sitting there going, God, got that wrong, or why did we emphasise that when really we should have emphasised this? We're very conscious that the history of geography shows geographers being wrong about so many things. So I wonder if a few people in the room have got some ideas about what we're wrong about.
Okay. There's Mike just coming.
I'm sorry, I jumped in there.
It's okay.
My question is not about what you were wrong about, because I haven't read any of your books.
Okay.
But could you just explain the colours on that map above you, please? Because you did give us a central point, but nothing else.
Ah, the colour scheme really is a colour scheme that Ben's picked out, and he's just really used it to pick out individual countries. Danny made the point that we could have actually taken all of the countries out because it's just reflecting population as such. And so don't worry too much about the colours. I think it was just Ben's attempt.
More to the colours. Now the colours, a longer story.
I knew that.
There will be this on the story. There's a website called World Mapper, which we produced over 10 years ago. Do you remember the Millennium Development Goals? When the Millennium Development Goals were announced around the turn of the century, so this is 16 years ago, there were 300 data sets that covered all of the world. So we decided to map them all, one a day, and we created a website called World Mapper. To map them, we had to come up with colours for the countries that allowed different regions to be coloured differently, but allow you to still see which country was which. And so what you're seeing there are the colours used in the World Mapper website. They actually circle rainbow style from the most developed country in the world, which was Japan region, longest life expectancy, through, if you can do, I can't do Richard of York gave battle in vain backwards, but through to red in the Congo in Central Africa for the poorest part of the world. So there is a reason for the particular colours, but it's a legacy of something done 16 years earlier.
Hi, I'm a social anthropologist by training, and one thing seems very clear to me by your... I'm a social anthropologist, one thing very clear to me by all your maps, there is no culture, there is no ideology of visualising any of your maps so far. People seem to be empty vessels. What about the great ideologies? What about the religions? Well, how do these affect our world in your view? It all seems to be about resources, about connectivity, about economic movements, but people are a little bit more complicated by that. Wars are not just based on resources.
Let me have a go at that one. You're right, we only had 7 maps. On World Mapper, we have drawn 32 maps of... I mean, there are more than 32 religions, but there are only 32 where somebody's actually had a go saying how many people with this particular religion are in this place. We do need numbers. We cannot produce these kind of maps without a count and a number. Of course, there are lots of people who do things without numbers. You can start off with a map like this, and then you could draw other things on using your imagination and knowledge to do that. It's if you like, it's a new base map. It's a projection on which you can then use for other purposes. But we do have a scientific bend, so we do. It's much easier to do it if you have. Oh, we've left a third dimension for history. Because then you can put that in and dive in it with a camera and zoom back to the 13th century.
Don't think that we're blasé about culture and social anthropology. I've just been reading some Tim Ingold recently, who makes some very strong observations about the role of culture and landscape and the way in which a whole raft of human behaviours shape where we are. But I'm also drawn very much to the work of certain historians who look at technology, the growth of technology, certainly in medieval times, which enabled people to put more energy to work, which enabled them to express themselves culturally in a far more diverse, active way, which captured more resources, which enabled them to build huge cathedrals in praise to God, or huge mosques in praise to God. All of this is really a technological expression of faith to some degree as well. But I take your point, 7 maps, they don't necessarily draw us into that complex and fascinating world of culture and social anthropology, but it's as we would make the clear point, as geographers, we pretty much embrace all disciplines and are blown about by them.
We're still a little bit imperialistic,
you know. Speak for yourself, Danny. Yeah.
Another question in the middle there. Wave for the microphone.
Hi, it's Nick. I've got a question. If you've got say plant diseases and crop diseases and human disease, how's that reflecting in the resources and the development of countries?
Of course, disease has been a weapon over time, and how the humanity or how the West so effectively subjugated the Americas was as much down to germs as it was to gums in terms of the diseases that we brought to them. And of course, our immunity to many of those diseases came from us living in close proximity to each other in the large cities that grew out of the Fertile Crescent and the interconnections that happened at that particular time. But in terms of the diseases that we face in the future, things like antibiotic resistance, though not a disease in itself, in terms of problems of alienization, it tends to be a bit of a alienization of plants, is the way that I meant to use that phrase. It tends to be an unfolding challenge rather than one that can be responded to with any precision. I think it's one that we're going to have to learn to react to intelligently.
But increasingly, the deaths in the world have not been caused by disease.
Yeah.
What's interesting is people still look back at disease's explanation. We had 30,000 elderly people die in this country last year above the normal rate in January and February. The immediate thing that Public Health England did is said, oh, it's a flu epidemic. We now know it wasn't flu. The deaths of people who died had dementia and respiratory illness put down as their final death cause of death, but it looking increasingly as if this was the result of cuts to pension credits, cuts to local bus services, cuts to home helps, halving of visits by social workers, actually causing this huge number of excess deaths in this country very recently. But between those times when we evicted disease on the Americas, one way in which we managed to become dominant over China, and which is taught to every school child in China, but taught to no school children in Britain, is that we insisted and used our battleships to ensure that we could sell opiates that we grew in India into China. And if you're looking at illness and life expectancy in the world now, it's a move away from things that were out of our control to things that are increasingly in our control. The vast majority of deaths of young people in the world could be prevented for very small amounts of money. We're just choosing not to. The largest killer of young people in this country, between 5 and 25, is the car. It's not a disease. And in other countries in Europe, they choose to control cars in a way that means that fewer people are killed. It's all about taking control and responsibility for ourselves as we begin to learn more about ourselves and about the world. Question at the back. Who can get there first?
Hi. This isn't so much a question about your maps, which I think were fantastic, and I'd like to buy a book to read about them more, but I found myself thinking about your assertion that, your confident assertion that you felt that the world could feed, you know, tens of billions of more people, which is very comforting, no doubt, for all of us to hear. But I was wondering whether you could say a bit more about that, in particular, whether that's based on hope or optimism, on the basis that hope is something you have, because not to have it would be unthinkable and probably, you know, too painful, or optimism because that's a personality trait and flies in the face of the evidence, and whether that in turn might have anything to do with red wine.
Okay.
I'm going to throw it over.
I'll do a short answer first, and then, I mean, the key thing is the tens of billions. If we get tens of billions more people, we're over. That's it. We currently have about 7.4. The debate is whether we're going to get 9, 10, 11, or 12. Tens is many more than that. In the poor world, half food is wasted through rats and locusts and going rotten. In the rich world, we've got better since food banks. There's a terrible reason, you know, why we've actually got better at throwing away food, because we have to have food banks, but we also waste food. But the greatest waste of food is feeding it to animals. And the most wonderful thing is that meat isn't particularly good for you. If meat was really good for you and it made sense to eat as much as you could, we'd be in trouble. Or even better, if eating a lot was good for you, we'd be in really bad trouble worldwide. It's incredibly fortunate that eating too much is bad for us. That's part of my optimism. But it's tempered with the latest data from around the world suggests a very fast deceleration in births in the last 5 years. We may well see the population stable at between 9 and 10, not even make it to 10, given the last 5 years of data. The only problem is that those 5 years are 5 years of global economic recession, and that does tend to slow people's reproduction down. But it is really dropping, and it's all about how many children we have in the future. However, the main reason we're going to get to 9 or 10 billion, the one we can predict, is ageing. It's people living longer. When global life expectancy doubled, the same number of people results in twice as many people on the planet because we're hanging around for twice as long. So the main problem about who we've got to feed in the future is actually us, because we're going to live into our 70s and our 80s, and if you don't drink enough wine, into your 90s.
I'm going to actually express a slightly heretical thought in modern Britain today. David Attenborough is wrong.
Hey,
I know,
you can't do that.
I'll keep you going. When Attenborough, a couple of years ago, he was talking to the Radio Times, and he said, and he picked on Ethiopia, and he said, it's not wrong to say that all these people in Ethiopia who are, and he did use the word breeding, because he's a biologist and he uses those sorts of terminology, and they're breeding too many people, and there are, and it's not wrong to say that this is a sort of fundamental problem. I agree with Danny that one of the parts of the equation that everyone just parks, everyone doesn't consider, why are global populations rising? They're rising as much to do with increasing life expectancy as they are to do with fertility. In fact, fertility actually isn't the challenge that we imagined it to be. In 1999, I took a photograph of my grandmother holding my first daughter in her arms. And in that photograph are two human beings who've experienced going right up the upslope for population growth with increased fertility, and right down the downslope. In those two human lives, they will go through the whole of the population growth dynamic. Fertility rates, with a few notable exceptions, Niger, we were talking about earlier today.
It's a tiny country.
Yeah, very tiny country. Maybe Afghanistan, but who can collect the data in Afghanistan at the moment? But with those exceptions, virtually everywhere in the world, we are seeing fertility rates fall.
And over half the world is below fertility replacement already. The majority of the world's university students are female, not just in Britain, worldwide, the majority are female. The best form of contraceptive in the world is going to university. University students do not have babies. It is entirely possible that we'll be sitting here in 5 or 10 years' time, if the current trends last 5 years continue for another 5 or 10 years, talking about the probability of how do we as a planet cope with what China's about to have to cope with, which is the effects of a one-child policy for a generation. It means that suddenly you're going to have a lot of very old people in China and a very small younger generation to look after them. Well, we don't know. It is up in the air. It's a very pertinent question. And part of our problem, and part of why we say geography is a subject of the future, is the future isn't settled at all. Tiny changes can alter it. But the way that fertility goes up is when you have disasters. You get baby booms after wars, as a result of the wars. People have more children after a plague, after a pandemic. If you look at the Gaza Strip, it has the highest fertility rate of anywhere in that region because people are walled in a prison. Disaster, insecurity, not having pensions causes people to have more children, because children are a form of social security when we're not all looking after each other. So it could all, and then we won't be able to feed each other. If we look after each other so that we feel comfortable relying on each other rather than relying on the children we will not have in so many numbers, then we will have fewer children and we won't need to have the daughters, as it was traditionally, who will look after us in the future. because we'll be in a much better place, a less patriarchal place ahead.
And a very simple response to it as well. If you had to pick on one major global factor which enables us to move to a stable global population with low fertility rates, let's hold our hand up for feminism as well, really. Feminism is a major influence on it. Yeah.
Question? One here at the front. If we're missing you at the back, you've got to wave more vigorously. As we get age, our eyesight goes.
I also wondered if there was an income coefficient in the size of these blobs on the maps in the future that you could actually sort of predict. Could you actually say that the higher income areas could potentially accommodate more population than the lower income areas could be disasters?
Well, let me show you that it's not so income, this is just population. But it's got a little thing. Right, anybody know where there is? It's in China, but where that thick of the bulge? No? It's the world's largest city and you don't even know where it is. This is why things go on.
Chongqing.
Yeah, Chongqing. And of course, because it's a city, it has a higher income. People move towards cities, cities have higher incomes. So the more populous areas are higher income areas. Not only is fertility falling, we're getting rural depopulation worldwide. We're getting people squeezing into cities and actually abandoning the countryside. Wolves are coming back in Eastern Europe. The wolves are currently in Germany. Villages have been abandoned across Europe, despite a lot of Syrians coming in. We are going to be a very, very concentrated population in the future. The great news about that is you don't need cars, which is good news. You don't need to heat as much because your own body heat actually heats up the city you're in and the systems you have and the refrigerators. And of course, you're freeing up more land to grow crops. I mean, this may sound ridiculously optimistic, but if the opposite was occurring, which happened in this country in the 1970s, it was called counter-urbanisation in the 70s. Do you remember when London was being abandoned? When the middle of London, the population was going down? Nobody knew how to sell a flat in Dalston Junction, where you could buy one now for 2 million. And everybody wanted to live in the countryside in a cottage. That would have been disastrous if that had continued. All the roads around here would be clogged with traffic. How would the health system possibly cope? You need people to concentrate geographically if you're going to get the carbon footprint down and the standard of living high enough to give them the services. And that is happening worldwide as well as in Britain.
Well, we've reached the red light stage here, which is means that we've come to the end of our allotted hour. I hope you found our exploration of geography interesting, and also hope that you've picked up one very, very important point. We are optimistic for the 21st century. This is not a world which necessarily has to be beset by doom and gloom and catastrophe. This is a world where intelligent people making intelligent choices collectively can actually move towards a much better place for our great-grandchildren. And we have to believe that.
And we're so optimistic that we'll be sitting in the book signing tent
in
about 5 minutes. Thank you.